how COVID-related labour shortages, shipping challenges, short-term thinking and climate change policy are among factors thwarting agribusiness leaders, or at least putting tremendous pressure on them. A report released by KPMG warns extreme pressure is crushing morale and causing fatigue in agribusiness leadership. KPMG Global Head of Agribusiness, Ian Proudfoot, delivered these sobering findings at a business breakfast at Field Days. Mr. Proudfoot says it's the toughest agribusiness agenda report he's had to deliver in his 12-year tenure. And he says the message is clear. Investment is needed to secure New Zealand's critical seats at the top table of the future food system. Ian is back in Auckland. Welcome, Ian.
Good morning. How are you?
Good, thanks. It's a really interesting report. It points out a lot of the morale hits are the short-term, very serious problems that all industry is facing. But there's one other point that really stuck out to me. It was a line that referred to the frog realising it was being boiled, which is the old story, of course, about the temperature slowly increasing. And when you talk about that, are you referring well beyond regulatory challenges and environmental challenges? Is it about the whole world of change, consumer demands, new production methods that are coming down the pipeline, Ian?
Yeah, I suppose we've been talking about a VUCA squared world, volatile, uncertain, complex, ambiguous. And we were talking about that 3 or 4 years ago, and just what's happened in the last 2 years, it's just become incredibly fast, complex, difficult and challenging. And, you know, in the end, we in New Zealand run our organisations very lean from a leadership perspective. So if you look at the companies that have changed their CEOs over the last year, in most cases, they've brought in CEOs from outside. Whereas if you look at companies internationally, there's normally a good competition amongst the senior ranks to replace the CEO. So fundamentally, we've got a small group of leaders within our organisations that have been taking all these challenges, as you've already referred to, the challenge of labour, the challenge of trade, which is immense at the moment, the huge and transformational regulatory agenda that the government's looking to implement, and all of the pressure from all of that's coming onto a small group of people. And, the pressure's been building for a long time. I think this year it's reached that point where we had really obvious fatigue amongst the leaders and a real concern as to whether, you know, would they have the energy and the bandwidth to step into, you know, what we're referring to as a great big beautiful tomorrow, because the food system is going through a global renaissance.
So we're talking about some of the obvious heads of the various farming sectors, horticultural and agricultural sectors, our biggest companies like Fonterra. What you point out is they are lean. You've just said this. They're quite lean. And you know, how do we address that immediately if you're looking at executive level and not just having job titles, but having the capability to share the load? Is that a real and immediate issue?
Yes, absolutely. I think we've run our companies tight for a very long time. And, you know, you regularly talk about things being run on the smell of an oily rag. I think in New Zealand, we've been running our organisations on that basis. And it's now coming home to roost. So it needs immediate response, and that's about finding talent and bringing talent into organisations. The challenge at the moment is a lot of that talent, a lot of those New Zealanders that we'd love to see running our food and fibre businesses are working overseas, and they're not the people that have come back to New Zealand. So, you know, we actually need to go out and find these people and attract them back into the country.
Can we pay enough to do that? Let's just cut to the chase. If we need them and we need them urgently.
Yeah, so in that case, if we don't pay enough, we don't get the bandwidth to connect to the future. And the reality is that, you know, we won't collect the value premiums that we should collect for what we do in New Zealand, which is produce some of the best food, a very high sustainability level with an ambition to take that to an even higher level. And, you know, that should be, you know, if we haven't got the people, we can't collect the value, we can't collect that premium.
Can you give us an overview of just how quickly the transition is happening into new foods? It's really interesting talking about this being the year that the frog got boiled, because, you know, maybe 2, 3, 4 years ago, we were talking actually to New Zealanders working overseas about the new plant-based productions that were coming through, whether it was meat productions or anything else, or lab-grown meat. And even then you got a perception that this was just regarded as la-la land. How quickly, and you summarise it in the report, how quickly are some of these new products or fortified products, or for goodness sake, 3D printed chicken nuggets for KFC that I didn't want to think about, but how quickly are these technologies actually coming to market?
Very. You know, as we talk about in the report, literally in the first paragraph, the reason we believe there is this great and exciting future for the future of the global food system is $65.4 billion has been invested into new and innovation in the sector in the last 10 years. There's likely to be another $20 billion this year. So that is a level of stimulus the food and fiber sector globally has not seen for 13,000 years. So it's been a very evolutionary sector as opposed to a revolutionary sector. We're now in a unique period of revolution around the food system. So the change is happening quickly. The new options will depend on science, but you know, the plant-based stuff, the transition of people towards a more flexitarian way of eating with greater awareness to their personal health and to environmental health of what they eat, that is going very quickly, particularly in the markets that we sell to, which are the premium markets where people are prepared to pay more for high quality produce.
What was it I saw as that market research of that premium end of the market being? The consumer concerns, mindfulness and indulgence. Is that correct?
Yep, and experience and, you know, environmental recognition of the product. It's, you know, when you're looking at those, we sort of thought when we went in to do this work around what the consumer, that, you know, whatever market we looked in, price would come out as the first item. But interestingly, price only overall came out, you know, 4 or 5 down the rankings. So, you know, it is things like, and it varies by region. So for Europe, it's very much about sustainability, about decarbonisation of the product. In Asia, it's about safety, it's about traceability, it's about the provenance of the product. But all of it, you know, we've talked about in the report the fact that we need evidence-based food. So that's evidence in the science that we use that underlies it, and it's evidence in how we produce it and then how we get it to the consumers to eat it.
Okay, so a big issue is getting sufficient talents into these organisations, not only to take the load off the senior leadership, but because from what I'm hearing from you, we're getting caught a little bit trousered down with the speed of this change. And that's not to say there's not great things happening, because we've done some recent interviews on some of the things happening in New Zealand, but you're now, this is now not niche, little tiny bits of niche. This is going to become fundamental. I'm deliberately going to leave COVID to last, because the second point you make...
Just on that, I think it's really important that we are thinking about scale. There is some really exceptional stuff happening in niches of the sector, but we've been successful in food and fibre because we've historically engaged at scale. Okay. And we need to engage at scale again.
Thank you. The second thing I want to bring up is all the regulatory change, and again, that boiling the frog, the realisation is this is happening. The climate change policies are happening. Some would say they're still only skimming agriculture in terms of impact, but there's that sword hanging over that if by 2025 there haven't been equivalent improvements, then the ETS could come more into play for the likes of dairy. Okay, so there's that change. There's the water regulation changes coming as well. There's various government agencies wanting the time of these people, probably 30 of them dealing with climate alone, 30 government agencies. Your point is government needs to think about this so that people are not spending 24/7 dealing with government agencies and consultation on regulatory reform. Could you explain more?
Yeah. So, you know, what the one thing I want to stress is we did not get anybody saying we shouldn't be thinking about our decarbonisation pathway, what we need to do to address water, how we respond to ensuring we've got labour rights and we don't have any modern slavery in our system. All those things are givens that we need to do all that stuff. The challenge is trying to do it all at once and trying to do it, as you explained, you know, there's so many agencies involved in so many of these areas that, you know, many cases the organizations are being involved in consultations on very, very similar themes from multiple agencies. And each time one of those consultations comes, it takes up executive time. There is a need to respond to it. There's a need to analyze it. And then when the rules come, there's a need to implement them. And in some cases, those are quite material and require fundamental changes to business systems or processes, again, taking up executive time. So the call that we've put out is actually, if we need our executive to have some bandwidth to think about the future, the government needs to ensure that as it's coming to organisations, when it's coming to talk about decarbonisation, it's doing that in a cohesive way itself. So it's joining up and coming and seeking one set of feedback rather than 10 sets of feedback.
There seems to be a push also from government to use what's happened with COVID to really heavily push for greater innovation and fewer low-income jobs, to be quite blunt about it. So automated yep. picking where that's possible, automation wherever it's possible, so that we're less dependent, on the levels of migrant labour that we've become dependent on. Is that being understood and accepted by the sector or not yet on the radar?
The labour issue is very much central to the radar at the moment. And, you know, New Zealand's food fibre sector is no different to any other food and fibre sector globally. There is always a reliance on lower cost immigrant labour to do manual jobs. And that's just been inherent in the sector for a very long time.
But the government's trying to change it, Ian. That's my point. It's becoming clear that it almost intends using this situation to force investment where it's possible in technology. Is that being understood?
Yes. The challenge is that the pathway for the automation isn't as simple as just having a machine. If you're looking at horticulture, it requires fundamental redesign of the growing area as well. So it's the people are accepting that this is a change that will have to happen, and it's a change that they see the benefits of happening as well. But what we're being told by leaders when we talk to them is that the pathway towards automation in, say, the horticulture sector is probably a 10-year pathway. So there is no quick fix. We can't do it in the next 2 years. But in the meantime, if the labour does not flow back in, at least, you know, with an understanding that labour is not coming forever, but it's coming for a period of time, we are losing premium today. And, you know, definitely in the sectors I work across, the loss of premium from our horticulture wine sectors is going to be in the realms of $500 million to $1 billion this year alone, because we haven't got the people.
Look, it might be conveniently timed for field days, but just landing at 9 o'clock this morning is the latest export figure for food and fibre sector, the latest forecasts anyway. And the Ministry for Primary Industries predicting export revenue forecast to reach $53 billion for the year to June 2025, and that will be record numbers. We know the dairy price is very healthy at the moment, so the status quo actually is pretty healthy. Your point is the framework underneath it is getting fatigued and wobbly, and we are going to need a transition from the status quo, and we're going to need it pretty quickly. Would that sum it up?
Yeah. I think that's fair. You know, where we're at the moment, there is a lot of pressure. Although prices are very strong, those prices are based on some fundamental things like the relationship we have with China. And what we've seen as we look across the Tasman is that relationship can change very, very quickly. So we need to invest in the future of the system, which is making sure we're incredibly sustainable, addressing the health issues that we have inherent within our own country, and ensuring affordable access to sustainable food for everybody in New Zealand, and then connecting with our customers to bring them the solutions they need. And if we do those three things, this sector has the opportunity to not just be New Zealand's past, but to absolutely be its future.
Your standout pointers, those leading this, and they're very good, some of them, are getting tired, and they need more people around them at the level required. Okay.
Yeah, we need the directors to invest in our people.
Ian, thank you very much. A very interesting report. Ian Proudfoot, KPMG Global Head of Agribusiness.